I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today, we'll talk to the executive producers of Brick City, premiering on the Sundance Channel. Brick City is a five-part documentary series that fans out across the city of Newark, New Jersey, to capture the daily drama of a community striving to become a better, safer place to live. The show follows the citizens of Newark, including its mayor, Cory Booker, as they work to remake their city and their lives. And we'll have a conversation with the man behind the blog, The Urbanophile. Aaron Wren is an urban affairs thinker and strategist focused on the Midwest, and his blog, The Urbanophile, is a must-read for people who care about cities. We'll get Aaron's take on everything from city branding to the urban pecking order. All that, plus the latest news from Plan Edison. Stick around for more Smart City right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Newark, New Jersey has the nickname Brick City. The nickname comes from the architectural style of the city, but also from the city's reputation as a center of the crack cocaine trade. But Newark is attempting a renaissance with its energetic and impassioned mayor, Cory Booker, leading the way. Brick City is also the title of the new five-part documentary series directed and produced by my guest, Mark Benjamin and Mark Levin. Mark Levin answers my first question, and for the sake of clarity, Mark Benjamin goes by the name Ben. Newark, New Jersey has, in many ways, been the poster child for broken cities. Brick City doesn't dispel that image. What did you conclude was the big narrative arc in Newark?
I would say the big narrative arc is the tagline, change comes hard. I think you're right that Newark has been a poster child for all the ills our cities face, but now it's a laboratory for urban transformation. And Mark and I set out to see what does that mean? What does this word change that has become such a buzzword over the last year actually mean on the ground? And we tried to find a cast of characters who are on the front line of trying to change their own lives, their families' lives, their communities' lives, and their city's life. And it turned into an epic drama, really.
It is indeed an epic drama. Now, one of the main actors, of course, is Mayor Cory Booker. He appears in Brick City as this relentlessly upbeat, hands-on leader. I mean, you can't help but fall in love with the guy. But it also felt like it was Cory versus problems so big that they can't be vanquished. Ben, what was your impression?
In Newark, like 50 other large American cities, there's this so-called war at home going on in the urban section of major cities across America. And the battle Cory Booker is waging for public safety is not different than the battle, you know, mayors in all these cities are facing. He comes to it with quite a pedigree as a politician, and he's doing the best he can. There's, you know, with so many guns in so many people's hands, so many illegal guns in the different wards of his city, it's a Sisyphean task.
I would agree with Ben that it is a Sisyphean task, but it's a task that and a challenge that we all face. I mean, I see Cory Booker as a charismatic evangelist of democracy in a way. Nobody says thank you. Even though last year there was a tremendous decrease in the homicide rate in the city, it's not like people pat you on the back and say, good job. This is an incredibly difficult challenge. But what's inspiring, and I think what moved both of us, is that there are people like Cory and like the police director, Gary McCarthy, they're in the power. But there are also people on the grassroots levels, like Jada, like the Street Warriors, like many others, who are committed against all odds to make a difference. And that is inspiring.
Well, it is inspiring. And yet, as you say, they're committed against all odds, with the emphasis on all odds. And you said Mayor Booker is doing the best he can. The police director is doing the best he can. Is best good enough in a city that is so overwhelmed with problems?
If you're a mother of a teenager who just got shot in an event that the police call homicide, but for a mother, you've lost your son. So Cory Booker's efforts to you are not enough. It's never enough. So when we did this film in 2008, there was 67 murders, which had come down from 100. So he's doing a tremendous job, and he's working 60-hour weeks. But, you know, you've got this illegal gun possession. You've got a gang presence in most of the wards in Newark, like other urban cities across America. And it's not always a gang against gang problem. It's not like a Sunni-Shia battle. It's two men, or sometimes there's women, but usually it's young men, and they have a beef. And when the result of that beef ends up that one of them lays on the sidewalk dead.
I would add that we are a culture of instant gratification, okay? In Newark, when Cory Booker was elected 2.5 years ago, obviously there was tremendous hope and looking forward to progress. When Barack Obama was elected less than a year ago, the same thing. But we think just by pulling a lever, it's going to change. No, we're talking about 25, 30, in Newark's case, 40 years since the riot rebellion, where we have looked away and forgotten about what has happened to the heart and soul of America, our cities. The majority of Americans live in or right next to cities. So this is a tremendous challenge. But just because in 2 years, you know, 40 years has not been changed doesn't mean that it's not a beginning. And it doesn't mean, look, just like addiction and other problems, you make progress, there are setbacks. This is a lifelong struggle. So I think that's the real, if you just look at this healthcare debate that, you know, we've just gone through this summer, we Americans are too addicted to, oh, if it doesn't change like that, it's a failure. Oh, next, who's up next? That's not the way reality works. And what Mark and I were committed to, and we used to joke as we did this film, was we're going to put the real back in reality.
Let's talk about your point on cities. It's certainly true that some cities, like Newark, are still suffering in major ways. On the other hand, there are some cities, really many cities, that have turned themselves around dramatically. So some cities don't seem to have enough talent to get the turnaround accomplished. Do you see Mayor Booker providing enough hope for the future of Newark that the city can begin to attract people with options about where they live?
You have to look at that question in the light of the amount of poverty that exists in Newark and the amount of unemployment and the amount of fatherless children and the amount of returning men from prison who don't have a job, don't have a rehabilitation program in front of them. So Cory Booker, in 3 of the 5 wards in Newark, is facing this terrific challenge to deal with all this unemployment, all these, you know, single mothers who are having a difficult time raising their young children, the allure of the gang world that draws in young men who don't have fathers, who are attracted to the older G members. And this is something that Cory Booker inherited. It didn't get invented under his administration. It existed. So Cory Booker does bring hope. When you're a young man in Newark and you see that this black man from the suburbs has come to dedicate his life to building Newark, to growing Newark, and he treats the citizens like he's their parent. I mean, he has so much love for every citizen of Newark. So he does give them hope. They know he's Stanford, Yale, Oxford, Rhodes Scholar. They understand these things, and they know that he's 60 hours, 70 hours a week, 7 days a week, fighting for Newark. He's raised over $1 million in philanthropy to help Newark. He's built low-income housing, middle-income housing. He's built 20 parks, renovated 20 parks in Newark. So he does bring hope to the residents. But there's a lot of hopelessness. So you have all this pain, but you also have the promise. And Newark, you know, does have the Cory Booker, and he does eloquently spell out the promise for Newark. Just the citizens have to follow through with more parenting, more emphasis on education for their children, and then Newark will have the type of citizens that can grow it.
I would say that, look, your question about, you know, a young person who can't afford to live in Manhattan anymore, as we were lucky enough to do, you know, 30, 40 years ago. Yeah, they look around. They look at Brooklyn. They look at the other boroughs. They look at Jersey City, Hoboken. And Newark is entering that scope. It is at that point. Now, whether in 10 years it's going to be like what you've seen develop in Jersey City and Hoboken, I would say yes, because basically it's inevitable. It's so convenient to New York City. It's really as close as being in one of the boroughs. It's the sixth borough. It's got tremendous access to the airport, the highways, Penn Station. There are communities in Newark that are developing a creative community, a professional community. But again, it's not yet there. And this series is about whether it will get there and following those people who are trying their hardest to get it there.
I was surprised by the candor you were able to capture among city employees. There's one scene in particular where the police had made a major misstep that was very raw, very honest. Describe that scene.
I think that, you know, there are actually a number of incidents, but I think the one you're referring to is where there was an auxiliary police person who got involved in manhandling a news photographer. And the director and of police and the mayor were very upset because it was on the news. And again, it was a black eye for Newark. And you see them talking candidly about it at City Hall. And then you see the police director talking to his top team, very upset about how it was handled. This is one of the challenges, obviously, of doing a series which is not really a conventional documentary. It's not a reality show in terms of, you know, that it's scripted and you're telling people or it's a game show. And it's not a drama like West Wing or The Wire or The Shield, although it's very much structured that way. The key element was exactly what you said. Could we get access and could we gain the trust of these key characters so they would allow their guard to be down when we were there and have enough faith that we would handle it with some sense of integrity and not exploit it. Believe me, that was a challenge. It's an ongoing challenge, but I'm glad you took note of it.
Just to follow up on that question, how did we get that access for the candor? You know, Cory Booker was in Street Fight, nominated in 2006 for an Academy Award, didn't win. It was clearly a fantastic screen test. Our idea to go over there was originally about the Bloods and the Crips and this war going on in Newark between gangs. And we certainly wanted to get Cory Booker involved, and he did join the team. He knew all along, and he actually said to us, I don't want a Cory Booker film. And we said, no problem. We want to make a Newark film. So we were on the same page. The reason I think we got all the access is we came with certain credibility that he respected. We've got this very long history of working in urban areas, of working in jails, of working with African Americans. My old friend and the father of Mark Levin, Al Levin, was Bill Moyer's first producer, was a mentor to me, a father and mentor to Mark Levin. He marched to Newark before the riots, after the riots. He took Mark Levin to the I Have a Dream speech, the MLK speech in Washington when Mark was a kid. So we came with a certain amount of credentials, and he knew from discussions with us that our heart was in the right place, that we were empathetic. There's one story that I have to relate. When we showed the final 5 hours to the director of communications for Cory Booker, her name is Desiree Peterkin-Bell, she sat there. After we all blew off some steam, she'd just seen 5 hours of television about her city, and she's responsible for the public relations of that city and the Booker brand. She looked back and forth at Mark and I, and she looked back and forth, and she looked back and forth, and she kept nodding. And finally she said, the color purple, Spielberg got it right, right? So that was a major moment for us, that the inside of City Hall, the heart of who we'd really been working with for 2 years, had seen our series and approved of it and felt that these two middle-aged white guys got this city right. But we did have terrific access. We had it from the street up and from City Hall down. We knew the Bloods. We were well known in Newark in the gang community because we had made years ago a film Mark Levin produced and directed and I was the cinematographer on called Bangin' in Little Rock, Gang War. So many of the Bloods and so many of the G's in the hood knew who we were because we made this film that they were all familiar with. So we had respect on the street, and we certainly had respect from Cory Booker because he knew where we'd been for years, you know, making award-winning documentaries for television for the PBSs and the HBOs and all the networks. So we were fortunate to have his respect, and we certainly had the streets.
How do you view gang members? Do you come to it simply agnostically? Here's a story. It's an interesting story. Do you feel at all judgmental? I'm curious about your personal reaction to their stories.
Well, as Mark said, we've been on this beat for a while, and really the initiation was gang war banging in Little Rock back in the summer of 1993 in Little Rock, right after Clinton was elected and right in his hometown. And we were caught in a drive-by that became pretty famous when it went on HBO. And that was kind of an initiation. And obviously we did the film Slam. We did the film Thug Life. I think at first this was alien to me. I certainly remember first going down to Little Rock and thinking, these kids are out of their minds, claiming their bloods, Crips, gangster disciples, vice lords, you know, whites, blacks, girls, boys. It was insane and made little sense to me. But over the years, as certainly as I've gotten more and more familiar with characters, it's, I hate to say it, but it's almost like the Boy Scouts and Little League, in that this has kind of become institutionalized, certainly in the inner cities and in the suburbs. I mean, that's why we went to Little Rock. Who would have thought that there was a gang scene in Little Rock? And in fact, as Mark said, when he first called me and told me that some Bloods were interested in doing a documentary, I went out and met them with Mark in Newark. They were not thugged out. They were articulate young guys, and they had a pretty clear vision of what they wanted to do. And they said to me, you're from Maplewood. And I said, yeah, that's right. And they said, well, you know what we call it? We call it Maple Hood. And I had never heard that term. And they said, you should drive by Columbia High School, your old alma mater, and look up at the CHS. You're going to see the C crossed out. And I was like, wait a second. Are you telling me some Blood climbed up there and crossed out the C, and that they're Bloods and Crips in Columbia High School? And they all nodded. And they said, you know, you guys have been all over the world. You've done these films all around the country. Mark, it's time to come home. You don't know what's happening in your own backyard. That haunted me. And I think, look, this is the reality that a lot of young people, this is where they find the love, the community, the family, the sense of purpose. It's frightening, the violence. Obviously, the drug trade, the war on drugs, is another beat Mark and I have covered for years. It's madness. It makes no sense. We've criminalized a mental health problem. Maybe people are finally waking up. It's like Prohibition. I don't condone some of the lunacy and the madness and the violence, but I have come to respect many, many of these young people, like the author Jawe, who was in our series and who just wrote a book, War of the Bloods in My Veins. And when I read it, I was deeply moved by his version of how he grew up and how he was brought into the whole gang world. So it's complicated. But there are times I've looked at Mark and said, you know, for a lot of young people in this world, it's either G or jihad, meaning you're either a gangster. And I'm not just talking about America. I'm talking about Haiti and South Africa and Eastern Europe. What are the choices we're giving young people? Not that many of them believe, hey, if I go to school and I get a good job, you know, I'm going to be able to provide a great living for my family and my kids are going to have a better deal than I do. That's how we grew up. But the faith in that social contract has been shattered.
Just on my part in particular, my interest in what was drew me to Newark originally was this activity going on that I had no idea about called de-ganging. Where in the case of this author we just mentioned, Jawe Dashaun Morris, who has a Simon Schuster book that's out now in paperback, he is actually a gang member who is inactive now. He's not banging anymore. And he goes out and does an activity called de-ganging. He's not suggesting to the current gang members to drop out of the gangs. He wants to redirect the actions of the gang members inside of gangs. But he makes a very strong effort on a month-to-month basis. He's out there speaking to young kids, and he's telling them, don't go up in the gangs. And I understand, and I've talked to gang members and people who study and write about gangs around the country, that this is a national effort, that gang members around the country are going into the communities, into the projects, and talking to the young kids and telling them, if you go the gang route, you're going to end up dead or in jail, and you're just going to have a list of obituaries of all your friends, and you're going to tattoo your arms with all your friends, but you're going to die or you're going to be in jail. So one way to slow down the gang growth is to stop the source from the bottom of the feeders of the young kids into the gangs. And that attracted me early in the process, and you see that in the film.
And I just to finish that thought, I would say I've become convinced that is the most effective way to really help kids at risk not to fall into that black hole. Just like AA and NA and all these self-help groups, it's the people who've lived it who are going to be the frontline warriors on bringing change. And that's where Jada, this young woman who is in our series, is really such a compelling character, how she has transitioned. She still claims her blood membership, but she is now an amazing mentor with these young girls, trying to show them that there is another way, that education isn't just do good. It's not something to be embarrassed about. It's a way of making a future for yourself. And I have really become convinced that these are the new civil rights workers of the 21st century.
Also, relative to the gangs, we're not going to be able to arrest our way out of the gang problem. We can't afford to house that many people in our prisons. And you know that we're starting to release people from prisons because this economy can't support the prison population it has now. And over a year ago, Cory Booker and I sat around and talked about, you know, Los Angeles, where you have a deputy mayor of gang relations. So you have this outreach to gangs, not only arresting them and shooting them and trying to prevent their legal activities, because that's what they're up to, clearly legal activities, but some outreach to the gangs, because there's so many of them. There's so much membership in these violent, illegal gangs that you're never going to lock them all up, and you're never going to get enough snitches to catch all the guns. You can't expect a mother who wants to protect her children and is encouraged to rat out her girlfriend next door who's got a teenage boy who she is sure is in the gangs and has a gun. That mother is not going to rat on the other mother. So it's not going to work through the snitches. It's not going to work with arresting. You can't kill them. So you've got this gang problem in America. It's not just Newark. I mean, it's South Central. It's Cleveland. It's Oakland. I mean, you point the finger on America's map all through the 50 states, you'll see cities that have gang problems. And Cory Booker, we hope that this film shows Newark as one of the hardest fighting cities for public safety and trying to figure out what to do with this gang violence.
Thanks so much to both of you, Mark, Ben, for being our guest on Smart City, and thanks for the great work you've done on Brick City.
Thank you.
Mark Levin and Mark Benjamin are the directors and executive producers of the new documentary series, Brick City. Brick City premieres on the Sundance Channel September 21st. And now for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
Across the U.S., government entities at all levels are struggling through this economic recession. The state of New Jersey is in such a tight spot, it's threatening to slash aid to its local governments. In the face of these dark economic times, cities and towns in New Jersey are finding strength in each other. According to a recent article from the Star-Ledger, towns there are joining forces to share or combine local services as a way of cutting costs. Police departments are merging, fire departments are ditching city borders to create regional forces, and some are even considering disbanding local health departments and combining them into one larger county department. And while there's no real hard data about the cost savings of such measures, towns in the state seem to be willing to try whatever they can to stay afloat and in operation. Meanwhile, Portland, Oregon has just seen the addition of a new light rail line to its regional MAX rail system. The Green Line addition has been in the works since the 1970s and finally began operations last week. The new line heads from the southeast into downtown Portland, and transit officials estimate it will carry about 25,000 riders per day. According to a recent article from the Oregonian, the new Green Line is just the first of a series of expansions to the system that are being planned over the next 10 years. Funding has already been approved for another 7.3-mile extension, and three other branches are under consideration. Portland transportation planners say they are on their way to creating a region that is truly connected and served by rail. And finally, a new study by the University of Leeds reaches some conclusions that may surprise cyclists. Bike lanes, it turns out, may actually be a safety hazard. According to the research, drivers give bicyclists less room to ride when there are painted bike lanes on the road. World Changing points us to the study, which used a specially equipped bike that could measure the proximity of vehicles as they passed by. When streets had no painted bike lanes, drivers tended to keep more room between themselves and the bike. Streets with painted lanes saw drivers edging closer and closer to the bike. The results of the study suggest that removing bike lanes may make streets safer for cyclists, as drivers have to pay more attention to where cyclists actually are instead of where they're supposed to be. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, we'll meet Aaron Wren of the website Urbanophile. We'll talk about what he loves about cities and how some cities in the Midwest have failed to brand themselves. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Aaron Wren is the thinker behind one of my favorite blogs, The Urbanophile. He brings his background as a management consultant to the many disparate elements of city planning, and he's joined me today for a frank conversation about the state of the American city. Aaron, we both love cities, so let's spend the next 20 minutes talking about them. Your focus primarily is on the Midwest, and as manufacturing continues to decline, many Midwest cities have struggled. Do you see any promising signs of cities trying to make the transition and doing that well?
Sure, I do, particularly for larger cities. I would define that as over a million in your metro area or larger. Or if you're a state capital like Des Moines or Madison, obviously Chicago has done quite well in the global economy. And if you look at cities like Indianapolis, Columbus, Ohio, the Twin Cities, Kansas City, Des Moines, Madison, all of these cities are growing population faster than the national average and, in fact, are also having strong job markets comparatively to the nation. Obviously, they're struggling and losing jobs in this recession, but in many cases are below the national average in unemployment. So I think there are templates out there for cities that are doing well.
What do you think is the recipe for their success? I mean, obviously it helps to have a state capital. Obviously it helps to have a very big state university. What else are the ingredients?
Well, I developed what I called my urbanophile conjecture, which was if you wanted to be a successful Midwest city, it helped to be a state capital with a metro area population of over 500,000. And really, if you define successful as growing population at greater than the national average rate, which, you know, that's sort of a proxy, if you will, for overall growth, all but one of those cities fits that bill. Kansas City is the only one that's not a state capital. Des Moines and Indianapolis don't have their state university there. So the universities, you know, maybe not as important a role. You know, one of the things that I've kind of speculated about these state capitals is that because they're the state capital, there's people from all over the state constantly coming and going and different people from outside. And that produces maybe a little less rigidity in the culture and a little less rigidity in the social structure. So there's always kind of turnover in those legislators as opposed to some other cities that may have more isolated civic cultures that make it more difficult to change.
Time Magazine has purchased a home in Detroit, and they intend to report regularly on the city's attempts to reinvent itself. If you were that reporter for Time Magazine, what is it you would be looking for to suggest that things are getting better or things are getting worse in Detroit?
Yeah, well, I mean, Detroit is really, to a great extent, right? There's a little bit of a tale of two cities about it. The city of Detroit is obviously really struggled, lost a huge amount of its population. There's terrible racial polarization there, lots of corruption. Many of the suburbs are actually quite nice, among some of the nicest in the country. But the dependence on the auto industry has really, really hurt it. I think it's going to be a while before we could say Detroit's really turned around. Time Magazine is not going to be able to figure that out in even a few years. One of the most telling stats is domestic migration. That is, are people moving to your city or are they leaving your city? I mean, is this a place people are saying, here's where I'm going to plant my flag, here's where I'm going to make my fortune, build my life? And if you start to see signs that migration is turning around in Detroit, that would be, I think, one of the key ones. And we've seen a lot of anecdotes of artists and other people. So what I look for a city like that is it's got to find some type of aspirational narrative about itself that would, you know, really allow it to attract a certain sort of people. And I think that is really what has distinguished cities like, you know, Portland and Seattle it's not just bike lanes or transit. They created a whole kind of narrative about themselves that people could imagine themselves being a part of. You think of New York and Friends and coffee houses. So that's what you got to do. Detroit has to have the emergence of a narrative about itself. And I think the concept of the new American frontier might, in fact, be one. And it has to start attracting people in some type of significant numbers. If it can do that, then that would be a sign of a turnaround to me.
I think you are right on it with this notion of an aspirational narrative. Where does that aspirational narrative begin? It obviously doesn't begin with an ad campaign, so it doesn't begin with a branding effort. Where does it begin?
It's hard to say, though. If you look at almost all companies that go through these branding exercises, they try to find people always go back to their roots. I mean, even fashion houses, which you think about as being of the now, are always mining their archives for inspiration. They all have a certain look. And it's kind of a hackneyed term, I guess, but you think of brand DNA. What are you all about as a city? You know, what really resonates in terms of being true to the place, true to the native soil? And maybe it could come about as a result of a community conversation. Maybe it's something that happens organically, and then kind of a name or the narrative is added later as people observe what is going on from the outside. And that's where I think the Midwest has really failed, because it has decided to effectively adopt the narratives of other places as the gold standard, the baseline against which to measure yourself. So if you're Detroit and you look at New York or San Francisco or Seattle as the top of the urban pecking order, exactly what you want to be, you're never going to defeat those cities on their own terms. You have to create your own unique identity rooted in what you are. I think Portland is a great example of how to do that. And, you know, Austin, Texas has kind of gone with the keep Austin weird, funky college town vibe. Charleston, South Carolina decided to embrace its, you know, antebellum heritage and its history. I think there's Las Vegas wanted to be a gaming mecca. There's got to be something in yourself that you can really reinvent yourself around. And that's the challenge for us in the Midwest. What is it about this place, about this environment, about these people that really can be compelling for the future?
You didn't start as an urban planner or a designer or an architect. You came to cities out of personal interest. Tell me how you came to cities. What journey did you take that led you to such an interest and such an ability to analyze cities in such a thoughtful way?
Well, first, thanks for saying so. You know, I've always been kind of a voracious reader and learner and just fascinated with different things. I think I started out like a lot of teenage boys, fascinated with large construction equipment, and I really liked road construction. And I liked to go watch road construction projects, and I would drive all over southern Indiana where I grew up looking at road construction projects. I still like to do that, by the way. And I started getting interested in, you know, how they choose these roads and how do they pay for them. And so that kind of interest, it sprang out of transportation. Then I moved to Chicago and I became very interested in public transit. I actually published a public transit newsletter. It started in transportation and really just exploded from there. And part of it is, you know, my professional heritage is management consulting. And you think about the systems that make up a city: transportation, education, economic development, talent, brand, architecture, land use. So often, those are really treated as very discrete silos, often dominated by kind of an overly technical practitioner base, so like civil engineers and highways or planners and land use. But I look at this maybe from my management consulting perspective, so this is really an integrated system. All of these are connected in a highly complex dynamic environment, and we need to take a look at the whole picture of how these things all affect each other and what's the high-level goals that we want to achieve as a community, and how do we manage to bring all of our forces to bear and get them working in an integrated way. I think that's probably the root of my perspective.
You've introduced the subject of transit, so let's stick with it. You won a transit innovation competition that was held earlier this year, and I want to talk to you a little bit about the recommendations you came up with, because I thought they were interesting in many respects. It was the InnoCentive Challenge. Tell me first, generally, what it was you proposed.
The contest was sponsored by the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce, and one of their big missions is to make Chicago one of the centers of the innovation economy of the 21st century. And they do an innovation summit every year. In the lead up to that, they did a crowdsourcing experiment where they basically turned loose the question of how we boost public transit ridership in Chicago to a billion rides a year, which is a significant increase over today. Today, it's only slightly over 600 million. And so that may be a little ambitious. So my actual response is oriented towards hitting their goal of a billion. So keeping in mind, I wanted to enter the contest to win. But really, I said, and this applied to any kind of looking at transit, there's really kind of three key ingredients. There's ridership, capacity, and financing. You have to attract people into the system. You have to have capacity to carry them, and you have to figure out how to pay for it. And then kind of underlying that, you can think about the operating model. So I really looked at it in terms of ridership in Chicago is principally about two things. It's about boosting the loop economy and creating the maximum amount of jobs in the loop. And then secondly, it's really about land use changes that take advantage of our transit-oriented areas. Once you've created those transit addressable trips, you have to convert those trips to transit from an automobile. I've always thought people are not going to ride transit to cut greenhouse gas emissions or to save the planet or because it's the right thing to do. People are going to make the best choice for them based on the right combination of price, end-to-end journey time, and quality of experience. So I laid out a series of recommendations across those to really make transit more attractive. And then financing it, the capacity, I came up with a large number of things. They actually specifically said they didn't want any rail lines, which I don't think is realistic to carry that many new passengers. We need more rail investment here. And then paying for it, I said primarily we should use a form of land value taxation, which may not be realistic as a fallback, probably some type of income tax-backed bond because sales taxes are very high here.
Let's take a couple of the things you recommended because I don't think the logic is necessarily obvious. But once you dig into it, I think it's very obvious. First, let's take the idea that to boost transit ridership, we need to put more people working in the loop. Explain the relationship between those two things.
Right. Well, if you think about where transit goes, Chicago is an extremely core-centric type of city. So you have all these commuter rail lines that come in from all over the place. You have all these L lines. You have all these bus lines that converge on downtown. So the transit infrastructure is there to take you downtown from anywhere in the region today, whereas it doesn't even exist when you're in a place like Schaumburg or a traditional suburban business center. Even if you could somehow take transit to get out there, you're stranded on a, you know, six-lane mega highway, probably even if it's 3/4 of a mile from where you work, you're not going to want to do that and then walk across. The suburban environments are really not generally oriented around transit. So if you have jobs out there in the suburbs, then it's very difficult for transit to address those jobs. Whereas if it's in the loop, it's pretty easy. A job in the loop, the default way to get to the loop is on public transit. So the more jobs we have in the loop, the more people are riding transit because it's very easy to convince people to take transit to the loop.
You also recommended introducing downtown parking surcharges. Now, that would be a very unpopular thing to do, but I want to ask you why you made that part of your plan to increase transit ridership to a billion people.
Well, if you look at, you know, those dimensions again, it's price, end-to-end journey time, quality of experience. So to the extent that you increase pricing in these loop garages, you not only raise money for transit, you also increase the price differential and make it more financially attractive to people to drive. The challenge with that is to make sure you don't price it so high that you drive businesses out of the loop. But I think the loop is really reestablishing itself as the premier business district of the entire region. So that's really kind of the reason, particularly with these people driving to the loop during the week especially. You can think about maybe making it time-based when the surcharge would be in effect. It's really kind of inelastic. You have to go to the office. So if people are going to drive and are just committed to driving no matter what, they'll probably pay. You can't just not go to work. But the idea is you want to incentivize people to go to transit.
I was on the new Seattle light rail recently, and it was interesting to me that I think what they had done there is they had made a trade-off between serving a low-income population for part of the transit route and maybe an area of the city that was denser that had more opportunity to build ridership. One of the interesting things is the roads, for instance, coming into the main road where the transit existed were quite short. And in part, it was because of the contours of the land. There was a hill, there was a mountain, there was something there that prevented the roads from going through. And I thought, my gosh, they only have, you know, two blocks, three blocks of potential density here to get riders near the rail line. So it seemed to me, again, it was a political decision rather than a good transit decision. I'm sure you've seen a lot of that in these cities that are searching to build the coalition to support transit.
Absolutely. And it's, and clearly it's one of the things that I think is a legitimate concern. Maximizing ROI or profit maximization type schemes are great in the business world, but in political world, in a government world, we have to worry about serving the whole community. And fortunately, in Chicago, we have large numbers of minority communities that are very well oriented towards transit-oriented service. And in fact, the busiest station in the entire CTA system, I believe, is 95th Street on the south side, actually. I think there's really a danger, and I see this played out over and over again in these Midwest cities, that they allow themselves to propose a light rail line typically to the area where there's the greatest suburban growth, and it can kind of easily be portrayed as the rich white man's choo-choo. You've got that situation in Cincinnati right now where a coalition, an odd coalition made up of really anti-tax Republicans and the local NAACP are ganging up to oppose a streetcar system downtown. And they're actually going to put an amendment on the city charter to prohibit that. And so that's the sort of thing that, like, if you feel that you can just ignore certain communities, it's going to come back to bite you. You certainly need to look at how you're serving the community and building the coalition around transit and making sure that these investments are really good for the whole community. I really think, in general, that's where too much talk about the new economy is really broken down. And we haven't made it real to people who don't have college degrees what's in it for them for supporting any of these new policies. So understanding and articulating to people how it benefits the whole community is really critical.
What is the essential evaluation that one does on rail versus BRT? What do those numbers look like, and when would you choose rail over BRT?
What we found is, you know, bus rapid transit is really kind of a catch-all for any number of services. There are basically some bus rapid transit systems, like what they have in Curitiba or Bogota, Colombia, that are really all but rail lines. They just happen to run on rubber wheels, much like the Paris subway system runs on rubber wheels, but it's still a metro system. And then others are really just more like express buses with some dedicated lanes on roads. So I think it's difficult to really define what you mean by BRT system. Clearly, where you would be able to really get a lot of grade separations and very high volume is where you would link yourself towards rail. Some advocates claim that, you know, rail, because it appears to be more of a fixed service, is therefore much more attractive than bus because people will have confidence to invest along a rail line. I tend to take the view that buses are more flexible. So that's actually a good thing, that buses can change over time to meet new developments or new demands or to deal with operational issues.
You posted a couple of entries on your blog recently that I want to talk about. The first is your analysis of the Burnham Plan for Chicago. I thought that was so powerful, and there are things that you pointed out about the Burnham Plan and the way it was presented and sold that you think has great relevance for cities today that are trying to sell big visions and sometimes trying to sell big investments that don't necessarily have a big vision attached to them when you think they should. Talk a little bit about the lessons of the Burnham Plan and what we should take from that today when we're trying to sell new investments and things that cost a lot of money, like new rail.
I think Burnham did a lot of smart things that I probably can't touch on all of them in the time that we have. But among them, I think, is really, he did pull it all together, and so he did a couple things. One, he kind of glommed on to a lot of things that were already in the works or partially completed. So things like a Michigan Avenue bridge were already being debated. There were already parks on the lakefront when he started his plan. There were already movements about forest preserves. But he took all of this and put it together into a cohesive plan. It wasn't just about this bridge or that lakefront, but he drew this kind of comprehensive vision. And also by combining all of that, as these things that were kind of more in the pipe already came to be, it kind of showed the momentum of the plan, and you could start picking these things off quickly. And beyond that, he sort of mixed some of those more tangible concrete items with the more conceptual, you know, ring road networks and things that he really didn't have an exact idea in mind of what we needed. It was more of a concept. He took all that, he packaged it together into a very comprehensive, authoritative document. They commissioned an artist to do gorgeous full-color plates with these just paintings. And I think today, if we see Chicago, we think it's always been this way. But in 1909, I mean, Chicago was a filthy, crowded, dangerous place. And he drew these gorgeous pictures of a spacious, well-ordered city with these beautiful parks and boulevards and lakefront. And people could see this and go, wow, this is Chicago. This is what we could have. He really was able to create a vision that even a kid could look at and really see what that future could be when you brought all these things together. And then, of course, they really followed through with the sales plan. They had to vote innumerable times to raise taxes, to issue bonds. One of the most notable aspects, they thought a lot about how to do it. There's a legal appendix in this plan that's like, you know, a third of the text. That even it was remarkable. It anticipates that Kelo decision from Connecticut by a century. And so they really just followed all the right things to get it done.
Explain the Kelo decision.
Well, that was where the Supreme Court ruled that it was permissible to use eminent domain to forcibly take land and give it to another private developer for economic development purposes. And what they said in Burnham's legal analysis was basically if the state legislature authorizes it, and the state Supreme Court upholds it, it's very unlikely that the U.S. Supreme Court would overrule it, as they were thinking about how to acquire all the land. So they were right.
You recently criticized CTA for not adopting the lessons of the Burnham Plan. Talk a little bit about this. This was when CTA announced its expansion plans and the money that would be required to fund those expansion plans, the Chicago Transit Authority. You said they failed to learn the local lessons.
Yeah. First, I do give the CTA a lot of credit for the improvements they made. I'm not per se a CTA critic, but I would say if you look at it, really, there is no vision out there of what life in Chicago is going to be like if we invest in our transit system. If you go out to the websites that basically tell us we need to invest $10 billion just to fix the system we got, I mean, who's going to sign up to that? I call it the rusty furnace effect. You know, you get this 20-year-old furnace in your closet there, and it's kind of rickety, and you open it up, and you look at it, and you say, well, gosh, I could spend $6,000 and replace this furnace. Or every time it breaks, I can shell out $250 to the repairman to come tinker with it. We're probably going to hang on to that old furnace until we absolutely conks out. And that's sort of where we are. I mean, $10 billion just to keep what you got is not very inspiring, and nobody really wants to do it. And that's why furnace people are always touting energy efficiency and other hooks. You got to have a hook. And then when there are projects to expand the system, they're often presented as kind of individual projects as opposed to part of a more comprehensive vision. And that tends to make them more local, kind of parochial interests. So we want to extend the Red Line from 95th to 130th Street. That, I think, is a very needed project, but I'm probably never going to ride it. So although I won't oppose it, I'm probably not likely to really rally behind it. See, you don't create a lot of community demand behind a comprehensive system.
Have you had a chance to talk to CTA about this?
I did get invited in to present to them after I won the transit competition, so I shared that with them, and they obviously got a copy of what I had, and I did send over my blog post to them kind of as a courtesy, but I haven't demanded that they comply or anything.
That might be a losing proposition, but nonetheless, I think you are exactly right, and it didn't really occur to me what was wrong, what was unexciting about it. The plan to invest the money in improving the system, even as a daily rider, it didn't occur to me what was wrong with the plan until I read your blog post. So I appreciate you illuminating it for me. Let me ask you one final question. What are the big urban stories that aren't getting enough coverage?
I would say, You know, one of the things that's really – I've really noticed, and you're seeing this all over the country. I notice it all over the Midwest, is really how engaged the 20-something millennial generation really is around urban issues. And you see some of this out in the papers of people talk about, you know, changing lifestyle preferences. And there really is some of that. But if you go to any of these Midwest cities, you'll find bloggers like a blog like Urban Cincy in Cincinnati. And it's a Generation Y guy who's just passionate about his city, really out there pushing it. And so it's really kind of the impetus for change. And you've kind of got this old guard of leadership who are doing things the traditional way, but there's all this these younger people really perking down kind of in the subsoil with all these great new inventive ideas. And I think you're really going to see some of this start to come to the surface. I think one of the places to watch for it, interestingly, would be a Youngstown. Because they've fallen so far, you know, really they're letting all kinds of people loose to try out interesting ideas. And I think you're going to start seeing some of these younger people get a shot at the title on some of these projects. And the cities that really step up and allow that, I think, are some of the ones that will differentiate themselves.
Aaron, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City. And let me just say, your Urbanophile blog is really just among the best in this field, and I appreciate the work you do so much.
Thank you very much for having me, and I appreciate the kind words.
Aaron Wrenn is the author of The Urbanophile, a blog of urban affairs and the future of the Midwestern city. We have a link to his site on ours, smartcityradio.com. There's lots more Smart City on our website, smartcityradio.com. You can read my blog, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or subscribe to the podcast. You can also get in touch with us by clicking on the contact button or by emailing us questions to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. I'm Carol Coletta.